So I've been asked to talk about solutions to supergravity theories, and I'm going to talk mostly about black hole solutions and generalizations of the black hole solutions, because these are the ones that play the most important role in the recent developments in string theory. I plan to cover three main topics. I'm going to start at the very beginning. I assume that many of the mathematicians here haven't taken a course in general relativity in quite a while. And and so I'm actually going to spend this first lecture reviewing black holes in general relativity. So the physicists in the audience will probably learn nothing, will certainly learn nothing new today. This is essentially just a crash course in general relativity. And this is really important because everything that we do later on will be very simple generalizations and extensions of things which are already present in this simple case. So in today's lecture, we'll talk about black holes in four dimensions. These are both charged and uncharged solutions. We'll talk about the global structure, analytic continuation, things like that. Then I'll move on to the black Hebrain solutions. These are the solutions of supergravity in 10 and 11 dimensions with all the fermions set equal to zero. So once you set all the fermions to zero, a lot of the complication that Gary Gibbons had in describing the full structure of the supergravity goes away, and one has very simple, generalizations of the equations of motion that we study already in general relativity, and the solutions are known explicitly. I'll describe the solutions, the extremal limits, the near horizon limits, we'll see where ADS comes out, and things like that. And then toward the end, in the third lecture, I'd like to describe some new conjectures which have come out of recent work in string theory. These are, based in part on these new solutions and the ideas you'll hear more about next week from Joe Palczynski and Hiroshi Iguri. But they're mathematically well-defined conjectures based on manifolds which are asymptotically hyperbolic. And hopefully, people here can prove them or tell us how to prove them. So these are generalizations of what's known as the positive mass theorem in ordinary general relativity. Okay, well, and please feel free to interrupt and ask questions whenever you want. All right, so as I said, we're going to just stick to general relativity today. So these are a solution in general relativity is basically a four-manifold and a Lorentz metric. Satisfying just the condition that the Ricci tensor is zero. So the simplest non-trivial solution was already written down just a few months after Einstein wrote down his field equations. This is the famous Schwarzschild solution. This metric is static and spherically symmetric. So we can choose coordinates in which the metric components are independent of t, and the omega 2, this is just the metric on the unit sphere. Okay, so we define R so that these spheres have the standard area. There's a one-parameter family of metrics here, parameterized by this parameter M. And the topology, the manifold M, on which this is defined, is R2 cross S2. because the coordinate r just goes from 0 to infinity. R equals 0 is a curvature singularity. R equals to 2m, where this metric is also ill-behaved, is not a singularity. It's just a coordinate singularity, which we'll deal with in just a second. But first of all, let me just point out the interpretation of m. M is the total mass of the space-time. And that comes from just looking at the behavior at large r. At large r, the metric obviously approaches a flat metric. The curvature becomes very weak. You can compare with Newtonian gravity. And the motion of geodesics in this metric at large r agrees with what we have in ordinary Newtonian mechanics if you interpret m as the total mass. And I should also mention that if you're worried about units, I'm using the usual conventions that the fundamental Newton's constant and speed of light are set equal to 1. Okay. The importance of this metric comes from two different uniqueness theorems. So there is, first of all, Birkhoff's theorem, which says that this metric, the Schwarzschild metric, is the only spherically symmetric solution of Einstein's equation, spherically symmetric Ricci flat Lorentzian space. So you don't have to assume that it's static. If you simply assume it's spherically symmetric and try to refine a Ricci flat metric, you'll be inevitably led to this. This is a rather easy theorem to prove. It follows immediately from the form of the equations. It was proved within a year or two after Schwarzschild wrote down the metric. And it really is the basis for all the classical tests of general relativity, because it means that the sort of geometry outside of any star, like the sun, is, to a good approximation, given by this Schwarzschild metric. And so all the classic tests of light bending and gravitational redshift and the precession of the perihelion of Mercury all follow from this. But for our standpoint, there's another uniqueness theorem, which is in some sense a converse of Birkhoff's theorem. This is Israel's theorem. And Israel showed that this metric is the only static black hole solution to, which is Ricci flat. So now we don't have to assume spherical symmetry. If you simply assume it's static and describes a black hole in the sense that it has a horizon, which I'm going to describe in just a minute, then it necessarily must be spherically symmetric. So Birkhoff's theorem is the statement that there's no spherical gravitational waves. If you assume spherical symmetry, then the space-time cannot be dynamic. It has to be static. Israel's theorem is the essence of the so-called black holes have no hair statement that Wheeler made, because it says that no matter what you collapse to form a black hole, no matter how asymmetrical it might be initially, after it settles down and becomes time independent, it will necessarily become spherically symmetric and necessarily be described by this very simple metric. Okay, so now let's talk about the horizon. To understand what's going on at r equal to 2m, we have to introduce new coordinates, because these are, of course, coordinates are not well behaved there. So new coordinates for r equal to 2m. The simplest thing to do is to choose something physical, like ingoing light rays. So we want to look at ingoing null geodesics And from that metric, it's easy to see that radial null GD6, if they're not moving in the angular directions, just moving in T and R, they're going to satisfy curves which say dt is dr over 1 minus 2m over r. And we can define a new radial coordinate, sort of r star, just by this condition, so that this can be easily integrated, and r star is just r plus 2m log of r over 2m minus 1. Okay, so if we introduce a new radial coordinate, r star, then the light rays are just going to follow curves of constant t plus r star or t minus r star. So let's let v be this coordinate t plus r star. And that will now be constant along the ingoing light rays. So in v are theta and phi coordinates. So the only coordinate change we're really making is to replace the old coordinate t by this new coordinate v. In these coordinates, the same Schwarzschild metric becomes 1 minus 2m over r dv squared plus 2 dv dr plus r squared d omega 2. And this metric is now perfectly well behaved at r equal to 2m. And so what does it look like? Well, the v equals constant surfaces are null. And it's very convenient to write down or draw sort of space-time diagrams in which null curves are always at 45 degrees. So we'll draw these v equals constant surfaces like this. At r equal to 2m, this term drops out. The metric is just this. This is still well-behaved invertible metric. And the only thing that's special is that the r equals constant surface now becomes null. So let's draw an r equals constant surface here. This is r equal to 2m. So on one side here, we have r bigger than 2m. And the r bigger than 2m surfaces are clearly time-like, as usual. An r equals constant surface is supposed to be a time-like surface. So if r is bigger than 2m, this is a time-like direction. It has negative norm. So these r equals constant surfaces out here are more sort of time-like, something like this. Whereas on this side, when r is less than 2m, the r equals constant surfaces are space-like because this term in the metric becomes positive definite. So they look more like that. And now you already see the sort of crucial property of r equal to 2m, which means that since the light rays are always at 45 degrees, if you're out here at r bigger than 2m, there's no problem following a curve which is time-like and goes out to arbitrarily large values of r. Whereas if you're over here at r less than 2m, there's no way you can stay inside the light cone and increase the value of r. R is, of course, still giving you the area of the spheres. So what this says is that just by moving forward in time, you are necessarily decreasing r. You are moving to smaller values of these spheres, and you will inevitably hit the singularity that exists here at r equal to 0 over there. So this is the black hole, the region r less than 2m. And r equal to 2m, this boundary null surface, is the boundary of the black hole. It's the event horizon. Okay. Well, you can now ask, what happened to the symmetry that we had in the original metric, which allowed us to send t to minus t? You see, the original metric was clearly invariant under time reversal in the sense that you could change t to minus t, whereas the description I just gave is clearly not time symmetric. You have a region here where there's a black hole and you can't get out, but here you can get out, and it's not invariant under sort of changing your direction of time. So to address that, we simply note that we made a choice here when we chose ingoing null geodesics to express the metric. We could have chosen outgoing null geodesic. So we could have used a coordinate u equals t minus r star, which is just the other family of null geodesics. And in terms of u, r, theta, and phi, the metric takes a very similar form, now with a minus sign here, minus 2 du dr plus r squared d omega. And this now also has a simple sort of description in terms of this space-time diagram. So now what we do is we look at curves of constant u. They're also null, but they're now outgoing, so we draw them like this. These are u equals constant curves. At r equal to 2m, again, the metric's perfectly fine. It's just, again, r equals 2m is a null surface. So now it's a null surface like this. Once again, the r equals constant curves out here are time-like. The r equals, the r equals constant curves in here are space-like, in particular the singularity at r equal to 0 is space-like. And now what you see is quite a different situation. Here, if you're inside r equal to 2m, you have no trouble getting out at all, right? This is the light cone. You're inside r equal to 2m. You can get out to r bigger than 2m without any trouble. But if you're at r bigger than 2m, you can't get in. Here, you're forced to stay out at larger values of r. So this region now, r less than 2m, is called a white hole. It's just the time reverse of the black hole. It has exactly the opposite properties, you know, under time reversal, time reverse of the black hole. So what we see is that Schwarzschild, that sort of innocent-looking metric, which I just erased over here, not only describes sort of all the sort of geometry in the solar system around ordinary stars, if you extend it, it also describes a black hole, but if you extend it sort of into the past, it describes a white hole, the time reverse of a black hole. And clearly what we want is to sort of know what is sort of the maximal extension of this geometry. What if you sort of extend it as far as possible in all directions so that it's as, well, it's maximally extended? And that's given by going to another set of coordinates, which I will now describe. So the maximal extension of Schwarzschild is given by something called Kruskal coordinates, and so in terms of these little u and little v coordinates I've already introduced, you let a coordinate capital X be 1/2 e to the v over 4m plus e to the minus u over 4m, and a capital coordinate T, which is 1/2 e to the v over 4m minus e to the minus u over 4m. These combinations come up because these are, in fact, just the affine parameters along these null surfaces r equal to 2m. So they're sort of natural things to look at. But if you introduce sort of those coordinates instead of the old r and t coordinates, then the metric is, so this is still Schwarzschild. Now takes the form, well, there's 32 m cubed over r, e to the minus r over 2m, minus dt squared plus the x squared, r squared d omega, where r is now to be viewed as a function of these new coordinates, and it's related to them by this equation. R over 2m. So, well, now we have what looks like a more complicated sort of looking metric. The important point, though, and really the key point, is to note that surfaces of constant r are now describing hyperbolas in this xt plane. And for any value of r, there are two pieces of this hyperbola in the plane. So you get the following picture. So if we just plot t vertical and x horizontal, r equal to 2m is clearly when this is 0. So those are just the lines x equals 0, or sorry, x equal to t and x equal to minus t. So these are both r equal to 2m surfaces. If r is bigger than 2m, then you have hyperbolas which look like this. Again, there's two of them. So these are surfaces of constant r bigger than 2m. And if r is less than 2m, then the sign changes. So we have surfaces like this. This is r less than 2m. And finally, r equal to 0 is just a particular hyperbola here, which has infinite curvature according to this metric. So we'll draw that with a squiggly line. This is the curvature singularity. But of course, there's again two of them, because t can have either sign, so we never have another singularity in the past here. And so this is sort of the maximal extension of the Schwarzschild metric. And what you see is that there's sort of this region out here, which is our original asymptotically flat region that we sort of started thinking about. You then have an extension across this null surface into this region, which is clearly the black hole, because light cones are always at 45 degrees here, and moving inside the light cone, you're forced to hit the singularity. This region, so I'll call this the black hole, this region is sort of the time reverse of the black hole. This is the white hole. You can easily get out of a white hole, but you just can't fall in. And now we have one more surprise, which is that there's this whole other region here on the left of the diagram, which is a mirror image or just a copy of the region on the right. So this is another asymptotically flat region of spacetime, which you get by simply maximally extending the original Schwarzschild metric. To help you get a little bit more intuition for what this is going on here. Is there a question? To get a little bit more intuition about what's going on here, let me do two more things. So let's first ask, what happened to the original time translation symmetry that Schwarzschild had? We started off saying we want a static, spherically symmetric metric, so there has to be some symmetry, which was just sort of increasing t. Well, in these new coordinates, sort of t over x, this capital T over capital X, is just related to the original Schwarzschild time by a formula like that. So surfaces of constant original Schwarzschild time t are just lines through the origin with different slope. So these look like, let me draw one more diagram. We don't have it too complicated. Okay, so we have this picture now of Schwarzschild looking like this, with all these, a singularity up here, a singularity down here, and these things. So the t equals constant surfaces do this. That's t equals 0, t equals 1. It's just these different lines through the origin. And the killing field, which was d by dt, sort of the symmetry, d by dt looks like this. It's sort of the symmetry which moves up in this region. It's space-like, taking you across in this region, because the r equals constant surfaces or space-like, so the symmetry moves you that direction. It moves you back, because clearly when you tilt the surface of increasing t, you're going to be pushing the points farther to the past. And then finally, in the white hole region, it again is space-like and moving like this. So it looks very much like a boost symmetry of the original, of Minkowski space. So there is a symmetry here in this metric, which is not obvious in those capital T, capital R, x coordinates, but it looks like this. This surface, if we ask what's the geometry on a t equals constant surface, that's easy to see because we can represent that by an embedding diagram. Here we know it's asymptotically flat. This is just a constant time surface in the original metric. Even in that metric, as r gets very big, in the original metric, it's easier to see. It's asymptotically flat, so we represent that sort of by a plane. As you come in here, r is decreasing until here. This is r equal to 2m. And then r increases again. And so that says this is a minimal surface. And so one ends up with a picture like this, where this t equals constant surface, it could be any, it's a symmetry, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's t equals 0 or t equals anything. Any t equals constant surface is going to look exactly the same. And it looks like this with the minimal surface at the horizon. And this is just the other asymptotically flat region of space-time way off on the other side. So even though we asked for a static solution to start with and wrote down the Schwarzschild metric, Schwarzschild is not really globally static in the sense that if you take a space-like surface like this and just move it everywhere into the future, I don't have color chalk, but if you just imagine pushing it into the future, these surfaces are not identical. Now, a surface which is over here is going to have this r coordinate giving you sort of the area of the spheres decreasing to r equal to 2m, continuing to decrease until some value of r less than 2m, because these surfaces of the constant r come in here, and then increase again. So along this surface, the geometry is a little different the neck, if you want, gets longer and narrower, you now have a minimal surface at some point in here, which is less than 2, r equal to some r naught, less than 2m. And the neck is longer, r equal to 2m is out here someplace. And it, again, matches up to these two asymptotically flat regions. And if you keep pushing forward, of course, the surface hits the singularity, which just means that the neck pinches off. And then you get two disconnected regions, each asymptotically flat, but each having a singular point at the center. Okay. It's a little bit awkward to keep drawing space-time diagrams which go on sort of forever. And so there's a convenient way of keeping all the sort of important... Yeah?
You described that process as pushing everything into the future, but I thought pushing into the future would fit it down.
Okay. So, in a Lorentz metric, of course, there's two light cones at every point, a future and a past. And we start off by defining the future. You pick one of those light cones, which you want to call the future light cone, and you continuously, you have to make that choice continuously over the entire space-time. And assuming the space-time is time-orientable, which just means you can do it continuously, you don't run into any trouble. So in a case like this, where we have Schwarzschild, you start off by picking a light cone continuously everywhere in space-time and calling that the future direction. And so what I've done is indeed move the surface everywhere into its future. The fact that this arrow is pointing down is simply a statement about a symmetry, which says, I mean, there is a symmetry operation here, which corresponds to pushing points to the future here and pushing points to the past there. And that symmetry is sort of increasing this coordinate t in that old form of writing it. But in fact, as we just said, since these are constant t surfaces, this is t bigger than 0, this is t bigger than 0, and this is t equal to 0. So increasing t in this region actually moves you into the past. There are certainly incomplete geodesics because you have this curvature singularity at r equal to 0. So any geodesic, like these null, ingoing null curves, will hit r equal to 0 in finite affine parameter. So there are definitely incomplete geodesics, but the statement is that all the incomplete geodesics are inextendable in the sense that they've actually hit genuine curvature singularities, and you cannot embed this space into a larger manifold with a smooth metric such that it's a proper subset. Any other questions? Okay. Well, so as I said, it's sort of awkward having to deal with space-times which sort of go on forever in these directions. And one would like a way of sort of bringing the entire space-time, even sort of the points out near infinity, to a finite distance, not changing any of the important qualitative features of the geometry, such as the causal structure and sort of the light cones being at 45 degrees. And of course, we know a way of doing that. You simply conformally rescale the metric with a conformal factor which goes to 0 so that infinite points get brought to finite distances. So now we can conformally rescale. And this is familiar in Riemannian geometry. You can sort of conformally compactify the plane by adding a point at infinity, things like that. The new feature for Lorentzian metrics is that null geodesics are conformally invariant. And so you don't, if you have two null geodesics which are not, which don't approach each other in the physical space-time, they're not going to approach each other after you conformally rescale, and so they need their own set of boundary points at infinity. And so what happens is that, say, just to sort of start with Minkowski space, I don't have time to, well, I'd rather not sort of go into the actual manipulations, but I think it's pretty easy to see what this conformal boundary is going to look like. So, as always here, I'm going to take advantage of the spherical symmetry, only sort of plot the RT plane. So each point represents a two-sphere. That's sort of implicit in all of these diagrams I've been drawing so far. So if this is the origin, R equals 0, of Minkowski space, then we have sort of radial outgoing null GD6 and radial ingoing null GD6. When you can formally compactify the space, you end up with a diagram that looks like this. There are actually two null surfaces at infinity, one of which is called sort of scry plus, and one is called scry minus. These can be thought of as just the endpoints of these null GD6. So you can think of scry plus as the sort of set of future endpoints of outgoing radial null GD6. As all of these outgoing null GD6 end up here on this null surface, scry minus is just the past endpoint of ingoing radial null GD6.
Yeah.
It actually follows. The statement is that if you can formally rescale the metric and ask that it sort of have a smooth extension to this manifold with boundary, and you use sort of Einstein's equation near the boundary. So this would be saying that the sort of the Ricci tensor has to be going to zero fast enough. Then you conclude that this null surface, well, the surface is actually null. If you have a cosmological constant, right, so that the you again sort of rescale the metric so that you require the metric be smooth extension to the boundary, then the same sort of conditions tell you that if the Ricci tensor is proportional to the metric, then if it's a negative curvature metric asymptotically, the surface will be time-like, and if it's a positive curvature metric asymptotically, the surface will be space-like. So it depends on the sign of the sort of curvature asymptotically. Yeah, Greg? No, this is clearly, yeah.
Right.
No, this is different.
In the Minkowski case, this is what this is.
Right, but you're making a distinction between the light-like lines.
Well, because light-like lines are conformally invariant. And so they're not going to, you know, you can't, these two different outgoing, null GD6 in the physical space-time are not going to be approaching the same point at infinity under a conformal transformation. Okay. So they meet when they're actually on a null plane in Minkowski space. So another way of asking your question is, you can take, now that we've conformally completed, you can take a point at infinity here and look at its past light cone. Okay, so we can ask, what is the past light cone of this point at infinity? And there must be a whole lot of null GD6 all sort of approaching that same point on the boundary. And when you sort of undo the conformal compactification and ask what are these null GD6, they actually are a null plane. A null plane in Minkowski space all approach the same point at this boundary. So things, null GD6, which are just related by sort of translations in some orthogonal space-like direction. Okay, so we have these two null surfaces. We also have one point here, which is called the point at spatial infinity. And this is the sort of standard one-point compactification of the plane, or in this case, R3. So we have our sort of T equals constant surface, and it sort of hits this point at infinity, which makes us into a three-sphere. But the sort of interesting thing is that in this Lorentzian context, all the T equals constant surfaces, the whole sort of family of these planes, are compactified with the same point at infinity. So there's only one point here, I0. There's one point, and it's sort of at spatial infinity. Okay. So let me now write down Schwarzschild. If we do the same thing to Schwarzschild, we can do it twice. We have one asymptotic region over here. We rescale the metric to bring this into a finite distance. We have another asymptotically flat region over there. We can rescale that. And so apply to Schwarzschild. What you get is this famous diagram, which looks like this. Okay, it's just exactly the same thing we had before. This is now the R equals 0 singularities. These are the R equal to 2m horizons. And these are infinity, sort of scry plus and scry minus, for the two different asymptotically flat regions. And this is what's known as a Penrose diagram. Although it probably should be called a Carter-Penrose diagram, because Brandon Carter, I think, first wrote them down in his PhD thesis. Okay, so again, the key features are the light cones are at 45 degrees, so you can immediately see what events can influence what other events and where you can go from any point in the space-time. And you see the four regions, the white hole, the black hole, and your two asymptotically flat regions. Sure.
If you had used xt coordinates rather than r and t to do just 1 plus 1 then cross its space,
yeah.
What would the diagram look like? It has two points at spatial infinity.
Right. Okay, so there is a slight subtlety. This, I assumed, you had a sort of half line for R because we were talking about spheres and spheres have an origin. And so if each point is a sphere, then indeed you get a diagram that looks like this. If you're really in 1 plus 1 dimension and you only have, so 1 plus 1 dimension, then you have a spatial coordinate which clearly goes from plus infinity to minus infinity. So then the diagram would look more like this, where this direction now is, say, x. Well, so the x equals, t equals constant curves do this. And the x equals constant curves, you know, do something like this. But now you have two asymptotic regions, because you can go out to infinity at large values of x, or you can go out to infinity at large values of minus x. And so you really have two copies of infinity here, scry plus, scry minus, scry plus, scry minus, scry minus.
What if I had not 1 plus 1, but 2 plus 1 space to again come back to that?
Yeah, because each point here is now a circle, and going out to large, see, there's no negative r, so you're either going out to large r here with theta equal to 0, or the other direction would just be large r with theta equal to pi.
At that point, I know it's just a point. It's not a two-sphere value.
It is really a point, yeah. Okay. One final comment. I've sort of spent a lot of time on Schwarzschild, but this is important because everything is going to sort of generalize this. Just one last comment, though. The metric, of course, remains a solution whether that parameter m is positive or negative. And so if m is negative, then it's easy to see that the original coordinates are good everywhere. There's no horizon. So the original TR, theta, and phi coordinates are good at, well, everywhere for r bigger than 0. When there's a curvature singularity at r equal to 0. There's no change, you know, in whether these r equals constant surfaces or space-like. They're always time-like. And this space-time sort of looks like this. So this is m less than 0. The curvature singularity at r equal to 0 is now like a singular origin. The space-time is still asymptotically flat in the usual way. This singularity, which is not sort of hidden behind any event horizon, is sometimes called a naked singularity. It's visible to observers anywhere in the space-time. And cosmic censorship is the conjecture that you cannot form singularities like this from regular initial conditions. This clearly is something which is present at all time. In general relativity, so cosmic censorship is the conjecture that you can't sort of form naked singularities that are from non-singular initial conditions. In general relativity, we simply throw this solution out as being unphysical. It clearly has the sort of singular initial conditions for all time. It has this unwanted property that the mass is negative. We're happy just to sort of throw it out. In string theory, it's a little bit more complicated because string theory says that general relativity is only a low energy limit. And that means that the actual field equation for the metric is not that the Ricci tensor is zero, but that the Ricci tensor plus higher powers of the curvature, r cubed, you know, general higher powers of the curvature, this whole thing must be zero. And so there are corrections when the curvature gets large. The coefficient here is very small, so you don't see it unless the curvature is really big. This is the so-called string tension. But we expect corrections to the geometry when the curvature gets big. And people have sometimes speculated that string theory might smooth out the singularities of general relativity. And so that because of these corrections, the geometries might be non-singular. Well, that had better not happen here. Because at large r, the curvature is weak. We certainly have a solution, an approximate solution to general relativity, which looks like negative mass Schwarzschild. If, when you evolve in, these higher curvature terms come in and smooth out the singular region and produce a non-singular solution of string theory, then you would have produced a well-defined solution with energy less than the ground state. Minkowski space would then be unstable, and the whole theory would be ill-defined. So this singularity had better not be smoothed out by any sort of higher curvature terms. But it's interesting that we will see tomorrow other examples of metrics which look exactly like this from their causal standpoint, which we know had better be there and be allowed and be sort of non-singular in string theory because of arguments related to supersymmetry and BPS states. So it's not really well known or well understood what the conditions are, sort of geometrical conditions near a singularity, on when the singularity is a genuine singularity of string theory and is going to sort of make the solution unphysical, and when it's going to be smoothed out by sort of some sort of correction. Oh, and by the way, the positive energy theorem, which I'm going to talk about in my last lecture, has an assumption, of course, that you have a non-singular initial surface, and then you prove that the total mass must be positive. No, because there are other time-like singularities which are resolved in string theory. I'll give you an example of one later on. No, it's not enough just to say all time-like singularities are bad. Some of them are have to be there.
Hey, Gary.
Yeah.
Would it really be that bad if string theory moved out?
well, take your favorite vacuum. Take your favorite vacuum, and I can put a small negative mass Schwarzschild black hole in it and destabilize it. I think you're going to have a hard time finding any stable. No, but this is a flat four-dimensional. I mean, this is a four-dimensional. You can take this cross a Calabi-Yau, right, and run into trouble with four-dimensional Minkowski space. Tachyons don't have to be bad if they sort of flow to some other stable solution. But it seems to me that whatever the tachyons do, you can then add a negative mass Schwarzschild solution to it. Right? This doesn't couple to any of the matter fields, right? It's just a change in the geometry and lower the energy. So I think this would be bad. Okay, well, moving right along. So we've now sort of exhaustively studied the simplest black hole, the Schwarzschild solution. And I now want to talk about the charged black hole. So this is now a solution of Einstein-Maxwell theory, or if you want, it's the n equals 2 supergravity. See, that was really n equals 1 supergravity without the fermions, otherwise known as general relativity. This is n equals 2 supergravity without the fermions. And so if you take away the fermions, the action is just the combination of the Einstein action minus the action for this 2 form. So the solutions now involve a bothymetric, a two-form field F. The field equations, let me just write it out once, that you get by varying this is the Einstein tensor, the Ricci tensor minus half its trace, equal to twice this sort of quadratic combination of this two-form. F squared. And now we want to look for solutions. Of course, there are trivial solutions where you just set f equal to 0. That reduces to what we've already seen. We want solutions where f is non-zero. The charge see, if you're a physicist, you might ask, how can we have any solutions with electric charge? Because I haven't put in any charged particles in this action. I haven't put in any charged matter. But of course, we know that you can do that. The electric charge is just given by some integral, 1 over 4 pi, the integral of the dual of f over some two sphere. And so all you need is non-trivial homology, right? You need the two spheres which are not filled in by three surfaces, and then you can have non-trivial charge. And that's, of course, what you have as soon as you take your manifold to be this S2 cross R2 that we've been talking about for the black hole. So we certainly are allowed to have solutions with non-zero charge. And the solution is something called the Reisner-Nordström metric. And it looks rather similar to Schwarzschild. It starts off exactly the same. It's again static, spherically symmetric. The modification from the charge is just giving you a q squared over r squared term in the metric. And this is exactly the same factor. So again, these are like the original Schwarzschild coordinates. Metrics independent of t, so it's static, it's spherically symmetric, and has just this simple form. The Maxwell field, well, f, of course, is dA. And the vector potential you need is just minus q over r to get the charge. Okay. Well, this looks very similar to Schwarzschild, but in fact, in terms of its causal structure, it's very different. And that just comes from the fact that you now have a quadratic expression here, which can have 0, 1, or 2 roots. So first, let's consider the case when Q is big. If Q squared is bigger than M squared, then there's no roots of this expression. GTT is sort of negative everywhere. This is exactly the same as the negative mass Schwarzschild that I just mentioned a minute ago. And so these coordinates are now globally well behaved. The causal structure, again, plotting just sort of the RT plane, looks like this, with the R equals 0 singularity here and infinity, R equals infinity being these two null surfaces. So it looks causally just like the M less than 0 Schwarzschild. And for similar reasons, it's viewed as being completely unphysical. This is not a solution that we would normally pay much attention to in general relativity. Now, if Q squared is less than M squared, then there's two roots of that quadratic equation. This GTT is 0 if R is equal to either of these two values, R plus or minus, which is M plus or minus the square root of M squared minus Q squared. Near each of these values of R, the metric looks just like Schwarzschild. Those coordinates, of course, break down at both of these values of R, but following a similar procedure, you can show that those are just coordinate singularities, the metric is perfectly regular at these points, and you can extend the metric smoothly through it. And when you do, you find the following maximally extended geometry associated with that metric when Q squared is less than M squared. It sort of starts off looking like Schwarzschild in that you have these two asymptotically flat regions, sort of scri plus and scri minus. This is the larger of the two roots, R plus, which acts like the event horizon. But now when you come in, you find another null surface. This is R equal to R minus. And the singularity at R equal to 0, you see if you go to very small values of R, GTT, again becomes negative. In other words, the R equals constant surfaces have gone back to behaving the way they do at very large values of R. The R equals constant surfaces are, again, time-like. So we get these time-like singularities now at R equal to 0 past this inner null surface. But of course, you can do the same thing in the past. So this is R equal to R plus. This is R equal to R minus. And it just keeps going. So now you have another surface. You can keep extending it. So you find more asymptotically flat regions in the past here, more asymptotically flat regions in the future. And this entire diagram just sort of extends forever up and down the board. OK, so R equal to R plus, as I said, is sort of the event horizon. R equal to R minus is called the Cauchy horizon, or the inner horizon. And it's the Cauchy horizon because if you imagine evolving initial data for say, a wave equation, you need to start with some space-like surface. So let's take some space-like surface to look like that. And then you know that you can evolve everywhere in a region which is globally hyperbolic. And so that includes the space-time up to this R equal to R minus horizon. There's no problem evolving past this event horizon, but you can basically evolve uniquely initial data up in that region of space-time, beyond which, of course, you have the possibility of, information coming in from the singularities and the solution is not unique. Okay. So this is sort of the sort of generic charged black hole, that is not a black hole. This is this naked singularity, which we view as totally unphysical. So it's natural to ask, what's right on the border? What happens when Q is exactly equal to M? That is easy to see, is the smallest possible mass for a given charge. And so it's called the extremal limit. So Q squared equal to M squared, you get the extreme black hole, the extreme limit of the black hole. Here, of course, the two roots coincide. R plus is equal to R minus. You have only one zero, which is now a double zero. And when you go through the exercise of extending the spacetime and finding good coordinates, what you find is the following diagram. Okay, so it again sort of extends forever. We have an asymptotically flat region here with its sort of two null boundaries at infinity. We have one null surface here, which is the horizon r equal to r plus, which of course is equal to r minus. And now we have the singularity at r equal to 0. Of course, we have the same r equal to r plus surface in the past, another singularity at r equal to 0, and we can just keep going. So this is the Penrose diagram for the extreme black hole. This is a black hole in the sense that you have an event horizon here, and this, you know, you can't send signals from this region r less than r plus out to there. Now, this metric has many special properties. Question? That the typical black hole metrics don't have. So let me. Yeah. Right. That's a very good question. You could ask the same thing about Schwarzschild. You start with Schwarzschild, send in one electron, you suddenly produce this massive, you know, space-time associated with the charge black hole. The answer, there's two levels to the answer. There's first of all the level of saying, what do you get if you actually produce a black hole by collapsing matter in, like you do in the real world? Well, that already gets rid of quite a bit of this diagram. Because going back to Schwarzschild, if you say, okay, well, here we have maximally extended this vacuum solution and come up with a space-time which looks a little bizarre with these, of course, looks much more conventional than those things, but looks still a little bizarre because it has the extra asymptotically flat region. Well, if you're producing a black hole in sort of the real universe, you have matter, and so you only trust the Schwarzschild metric outside the surface of the star. So the surface of the star is going to follow some sort of curve, which is something like this, say. And so you should really be looking at the Schwarzschild geometry outside the star, throw away everything else, and replace it with the solution of Einstein's equation with matter. And what you get if you just take something simple like uniform density dust collapse is that, of course, there's an origin. This is now the regular origin of the sort of star. And you have the star collapse to form a singularity, which sort of matches onto the Schwarzschild singularity. And you get the horizon sort of extending back through the matter. And this is the more physical picture of black hole formation, where you don't have that other asymptotically flat region. You don't have a white hole, right? White holes have to be put in as part of the initial conditions. They're a statement about the behavior of the metric in the infinite past. And this is sort of the physical geometry of collapse to a neutral black hole. What happens if you collapse a charged dust cloud? Okay. Well, now things get a little bit trickier. If you Okay. So, well, first of all, before I get to that, let me just say there's been extensive study on the stability of this inner horizon, this Cauchy horizon here. And long ago, it was shown that sort of to linearize perturbations, this inner horizon is unstable. And you can sort of see why an observer falling in will cross this inner horizon in a finite proper time. But at the point he crosses the horizon, if he looks back, or she looks back, you see the entire future evolution of the space-time that you left behind. So anything which is sort of radiating here, the radiation not only sort of blue shifts, well, it blue shifts when it falls into the gravitational potential, it all piles up on this one null surface and becomes unstable. Recently, I mean, the original calculations go back to the 70s. Recently, people have come back to this question and done sort of some nonlinear studies. And what they find is that, yes, in a nonlinear analysis, it becomes singular, but it's not quite so bad. In other words, the integrated tidal force, the singularity, first of all, is not space-like. So initially, people thought, oh, you perturb this a little bit, it's going to flip over, become just like Schwarzschild, and you'll be done. That doesn't seem to be what happens. You actually form a null singularity, at least for a while. Then maybe it flips over and becomes space-like later on. But at least in this region, the singularity is null and rather weak in the sense that you can actually flow through it and suffer only a finite net total integrated tidal distortion. Okay, well, this, of course, is very important. This, of course, is very important for science fiction writers, right? You know? They have for years been saying that you can fall into a black hole and emerge in some other, you know, region of the universe or some other asymptotically flat thing. And surprisingly, relativity does not say that's obviously wrong. it's a non-trivial and still, I say, not completely resolved question whether in some sort of generic situation you can actually pass through that that surface. So it's something people are actively doing research on right now. Okay, well, to finish up today, let me mention some of the special properties of this extreme black hole and then quit. Okay, so first of all, it is a supersymmetric solution. Okay, so this extreme black hole that we've just been talking about, if you view it as a solution in this n equals 2 supergravity theory, has unbroken supersymmetry. Black hole sort of has partially, right. It's half, right, or something? Half unbroken supersymmetry. So it is, in some sense, the analog of a BPS state. And following sort of the rough discussion of the other day, it does extremize the bound. If you think of these black holes as like states in a supersymmetric theory, the mass is always bigger than the charge. And the extremal limit, when the mass is equal to the charge, corresponds to this supersymmetric configuration. Now, let's look at a surface. This is one of these sort of T equals constant surfaces in this geometry. And we can ask, how far is it to the horizon from any point outside the horizon? Well, if we just compute that, the proper distance to the horizon from any point outside. The horizon now is, of course, at r equal to m, because q squared is equal to m squared. So the proper distance to the horizon from any point r bigger than m, it's easy to see from the form of the metric that this is just dr, well, let me call this q, because that's sort of more invariant. So this is 1 minus q over r quantity squared in the metric. You take the square root and you just get this. You want to integrate from r equal to q to something like q plus anything, epsilon. And this thing clearly diverges. So this goes like log of r minus q evaluated when r goes to q. So the statement is that so evaluated at r equals to q. The statement is that this surface looks like one of these infinite throats. So I showed you what an embedding diagram looked like of the sort of ordinary black hole. This surface is asymptotically flat, but now when you come in, you have this surface which the r is, of course, approaching a constant. It's just r plus, which in this case is just q. So r is equal to q. The spheres have a constant radius, and the distance to r equal to q is, I should say r approximately q. The distance to r equal q is actually infinite, and you get this sort of so-called infinite throat. Even though on a space-like surface the horizon is infinitely far away, it's easy to check that an observer that falls in reaches a horizon in finite proper time. So it's not like this whole boundary is really off at infinity. It's really there as a finite part of the space-time, but on a constant time surface, it's infinitely far away. Well, I think I should probably stop there, and we'll continue tomorrow. Thank you. Any questions? Jenny? Right. Yeah. So, you mean this guy? This one. Nowhere near it. I think is a short answer. This type of conformal diagram is very good at showing causal relations in terms of what events can influence what other events and where the light cones are. It's very bad at sort of showing metric distance properties. So, for example, we know out here, we can consider, you know, this curve and this curve, or if you want, two different time-like curves, which look like they're getting very close and approaching the same point on the diagram. But in fact, in terms of physical distance in the original metric, these two curves could be very far apart, and in fact getting farther apart, because these are just two time-like curves in this asymptotically flat region. So they could actually be diverging and getting farther and farther apart metrically, and yet because they're past, if you go on forever, their pasts agree, they are shown to have the same sort of limit point on this diagram. So the same is true here. This null ray, I don't think, is metrically in any sense approaching the surface. In fact, if you look at the coordinates, of course, this is t equals minus infinity down here. Of course, the t-coordinate is getting ill-behaved at the horizon. But this is not approaching this in any sense metrically. It's just that causally, somehow, the past of a point as you approach here is agreeing with the past of the point as you sort of move along the surface that way. Yeah?
In the case of q squared greater than s squared, but m still positive, that naked singularity is not necessarily an instability.
True. I can't make the same argument that I made before, that if these were allowed somehow in string theory, you would have no stable ground state. That's right. Well, of course, it's very hard to form a singularity like this, because you have to sort of overcome a Coulomb repulsion. Right, the Coulomb force goes like q squared over r squared, and the attractive gravitational force goes like m squared over r squared with the opposite sign. And so, of course, if you try to sort of bring q squared bigger than m squared particles together, the repulsion will always overcome the attraction, and they'll want to fly apart. So it's very hard to produce something like this in sort of a collapsed situation.